our lecturer, James E. Pike of Chicago, Illinois, is a member of the Christian Science Board of Lectureship. Listen carefully and be healed, Mr. Pike.
Thank you, Sumner Davis. Good evening to each and every one of you. Thank you for letting me return. They say the bad penny will, and here it is. Someone told me a story one time about a little 10-year-old girl who believed that God answered her prayers. Her father didn't agree with that, often chided her in a good-humored way about it. Finally tricked her into testing the point on this basis, that for 1 week, she would just ask God for something that she wanted very much. And then at the end of the week, they'd see if she got the answer to her prayer. And so for a whole week, this little girl asked God every day to give her a bicycle. When the week ended, prayers and all, she ended up with no bicycle. "Well, what did I tell you?" said her father. "Doesn't that prove it to you now? All week long you've been asking God to give you a bicycle, and he hasn't done so. It's very obvious that God doesn't answer prayers." "Oh, but Daddy, he does too," she replied. "This time he said no." That's what you call conviction. It's assurance, and it's a very sensible concept of God. Not a doubt, in her thought, that God answered prayers. And as far as she was concerned, he had done so this time. This little story illustrates a fact, and it's simply this, that anyone can educate their thinking, that is, cultivate their consciousness, to the point where they become absolutely convinced of God's ability to meet any human situation. And if this were a true story, and we might assume that it is, then this little girl is well on her way to having a life without doubt. And that's what titles this lecture, Life Without Doubt. What do you think is the one word that best illustrates that kind of thinking, that state of conviction? Isn't it faith? Sure it is. It's faith. But do you ever ask yourself, what really is faith? What is it? That's the question you'll answer by only looking deep within your own thinking. Because faith isn't something that you're going to get. You've already got it. You're born with it. It's inherent within every one of us, just as normal and natural as feeling or breathing or eating or sleeping or loving your family and your fellow man. But what we don't think often enough about is that faith can be cultivated. It can be educated into a mighty power. Whether you think about it or not, we're practicing faith this very moment. We're believing in something. Belief is a form of faith. You believed it came tonight to hear a lecture. I believe if I got here through this highway system, you'd be here to hear it. We're always practicing belief in something. Faith is always at work. Faith in God, faith in man, faith in ourselves, faith in history. Well, I know people that have faith in a problem. They're smart, they got faith in an answer. Still other people believe in a rabbit's foot. Wouldn't dream of letting a black cat cross their path. Put all kinds of faith in patent and quack medicines. Do you ever think of the faith that an aspirin tablet gets in a 24-hour period? Especially that one with a time savings device in it. Still other peoples believe that medical and technical know-how are the great saviors of the 20th century. Still other peoples believe that wars will solve international strife. Don't you see? The human thinking process is made up of nothing but a blend of many types of faith. One dictionary defines faith as a conviction operative on the character and will. So faith is something that operates. It's active. It'll really do things to you if you let it. Webster defines faith as being the state of acknowledging unquestioningly the absolute presence and power of a supreme being and the reality of a divine order. Now, for that kind of faith, then, to be truly operative or active within one's thinking, one has to begin to know the nature of the supreme being that he is going to unquestioningly acknowledge. And he's going to need to know that supreme being to be good. But by good, I don't just mean humanly good. Do you realize that there are millions of people who are humanly good who don't even believe there is such a thing as God? But by good, I mean that word in its highest and purest form. And that, essentially, is spiritual good. Once an individual has educated his faith, that is, cultivated his thinking to the point where he can unquestioningly acknowledge the constant, absolute presence right here and now of spiritual good, then you really want to watch out. Because that's the life that comes on fire. And no one can outline then how far and how fast that life may go in achieving all kinds of greatness and goodness. This then is a potential for all of mankind, surely for every one of us, to learn to so educate our faith into an unquestioning acknowledgement of the absolute presence of spiritual good, so much so that every one of our hitherto hidden desires, all of the latent talents that lie deep within us, can come out and be made realities and actualities. And so that's really what I want to talk with you about tonight. I want to talk with you about life without doubt. And that primarily means a life of faith. Faith, however, that has been raised, elevated, educated, cultivated to its highest level. Faith that is an absolutely scientific certainty of the immediate presence with us right here and now of God, who is spiritual good. How about everybody in this room knows the opening verse of the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews? Very famous. The one that starts out by saying, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." And then in that entire chapter, the writer has traced in chronological order the development of faith in the lives of many men and women of the Bible. You may remember that he started with Abel. Then there was Enoch, and Noah, and Moses, Sarah, Abraham, clear on down the line to Jesus, whom he calls the author and finisher of our faith. It really makes no difference where you look, biblical times or today. You discover that no one can do anything for himself or for humanity if he doesn't have a great degree of this quality called faith working within him. You know, you couldn't even bake a cake if you didn't have faith. And that writer of the Hebrews goes so far as to say that you can never have God without it. He puts it this way, he says, "For he that cometh to God
must believe that he is. You've got to do something if you're going to have God in your life. You've got to make God happen. You've got to believe. I saw a bumper sticker just recently down the Los Angeles freeway on the back of a little old Toyota that went by, and it said, "Does God seem far away from you? Who moved?" And then that writer of the Hebrews goes on and says, "And he, God, is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him." And that's just as plain as saying that all the God you're ever going to have is the God that you earn and learn to have because you diligently seek to know God. And that's the very reason that the science of Christianity is here today. It is here to teach people how to cultivate their faith into a spiritual understanding that will enable them to know the absolute presence right here, now, of God, of spiritual good. Someone who did this, someone this writer to the Hebrews speaks of, is the patriarch Abraham. Out of all the myths of antiquity that surround early biblical characters, no one stands out more vividly than does he. Abraham's a man who really loved God, wanted to serve him. But Abraham had gotten into a lot of trouble. He was all tied up, shackled, to the traditional beliefs of his elders. One of them said that he must practice blood sacrifices. That was a very pagan of voodoo ritual that would require him to take his firstborn son, lay him on the altar, and kill him. So in absolute obedience to the traditions of his elders, with his knife all poised, Abraham actually prepared to slay Isaac. When all of a sudden something happened, Abraham began to think. And let me tell you, things will happen to anybody if they'll just start to think. It was just then that the way opened up for him not to do this. Isaac was saved. And in that moment, for the first time in recorded history, mankind got a glimpse of an entirely new concept of sacrifice. A concept of sacrifice that would require all of mankind someday, you and me right now, to start laying every one of our earthly, worldly, physical, material, mortal, traditional beliefs on the altar. Kill every one of them. But never your son. And in that moment, for the first time, mankind actually saw that a progressive form of faith is intelligence. It's an intelligent faith that lets you do nothing but the right thing at the right time. It's an intelligent faith, then, that can progressively wipe out of your life all ignorance, all hate, all traditional beliefs, all doubt. So it was that in that moment, Abraham glimpsed the intelligent faith that let him go on and fulfill his high destiny. He it was, you know, who founded the nation of Israel. I wonder what Abraham thinks about Israel tonight. He proved, however, that God oftentimes answers prayers by saying no. We so often think God has to say yes to everything we're asking him. More often than not, it's no. No, don't kill your son. We can learn something about an intelligent faith if we look more closely now at a contemporary figure. Think with me, if you will, for a few moments. That very stern, cold, self-righteous, puritanical atmosphere of New England in the 1800s, there are a father and a mother gravely concerned about the physical, the emotional well-being of their little daughter, a little girl who at 12 years of age had written a poem with these lines in it. She said this, "Increase thou my faith and my vision enlarge." About 10 years later, she was married. Shortly after that marriage, her husband died. Within a few months of his death, A son was born to her. After waiting a proper length of time, she married again, hopeful of making a home for this child. But this second husband proved increasingly unfaithful, actually adulterous. Her son was taken from her, placed in a foster home. She herself was deprived of a home, left without income. Her already weakened health degenerated further, and she turned to every medical, therapeutical system of her day, hopeful of gaining some relief from her physical ills, and found none. But nothing stopped her from praying, from thinking, "Increase thou my faith." That prayer of the 12-year-old child just kept growing stronger and stronger and deeper within her consciousness, so much so that in 1866, Mary Baker Eddy, that's who I'm speaking of, was healed from the effects of a serious accident when she turned wholeheartedly to God in prayer. This healing was accompanied by spiritual illumination, revelation, in which she unquestioningly saw that the absolute source and center of all being, that is, the very nature and essence of anything that is genuinely real and true, is God, Spirit, and that man, individual man, each one of us, has the right to radiate, to reflect, to express in totality all the qualities of God. Well, there began a period of several years, years in which she devoted herself to deeper study, to writing, and in 1875 appeared the textbook of Christian Science, a book which we today know as Science and Health, with key to the Scriptures. Listen to what this book says, for example, about the patriarch Abraham. When you hear this read, you really begin to see why this book is called a key to the Scriptures. It literally unlocks the Bible. I minored in Bible in my college years, and after a whole year of studying the Old Testament, I never knew as much about Abraham as I do out of two short paragraphs in this book. This is what Abraham introduced into the stream of human thinking centuries ago. Abraham. Fidelity. Faith in the divine life and in the eternal principle of being. This patriarch illustrated the purpose of love, to create trust in good, and showed the life-preserving power of spiritual understanding. From that very simple little prayer of the 12-year-old child, "Increase thou my faith," clear up now to the life-preserving power of spiritual understanding that she beheld in Abraham, Mrs. Eddy's own life had come full circle. From a human point of view, you'll have a hard time ever biographically finding anyone's life more bitter, more agonizing, frustrating than was hers, at least up to this point. But now, with her faith ripened, cultivated into a spiritual understanding, why, she launched into an entirely new career. She wrote, she taught, publicly practiced the healing art of Christian Science, taught pupils to do the same thing at the same time, established an international movement, founded a great mother church with multitudinous branches throughout the world, laid plans for a great international daily newspaper, the Christian Science Monitor, kept herself totally dedicated to the Bible, searched the Scriptures to glean more and more of the spiritual laws that empowered the lives of the men and women who character that book. And talk about total commitment. She had that for Christ Jesus. Mrs. Eddy saw before her a whole new world of religion and medicine. A world of religion and medicine that is founded unquestioningly on the absolute immediate presence right here and now of God, of spiritual good. And she devoted the remainder of her years to seeing that every one of us could cultivate, educate within ourselves that same kind of a spiritual consciousness. It's exactly what this remarkable system of thinking is teaching when she writes this. When we, you and me, when we come to have more faith in the truth of being than we have in error, more faith in spirit than in matter, more faith in living than in dying, more faith in God than in man, then no material suppositions can prevent us from healing the sick and destroying error. You see, Mrs. Eddy had discovered and restored to humanity in this textbook that lost art of spiritual healing, the same art as discovered and treated and practiced by Jesus centuries ago. And so it is today throughout all the lands of the world. Christian scientists everywhere practice spiritual healing based on their own cultivated spiritual understanding. Just a year ago, I spent over 4 months in Africa, 2 months of it in Black West Africa, where those basically heathen nations establishing their brilliant young democracies have large groups of Christian scientists practicing spiritual healing with great skill. Not unlike Mrs. Eddy, not unlike Abraham, I too have experienced this more intelligent faith in my own life. I'd always believed in God. My mother thought of that. But my concept of God was really of somebody that I was going to die and then go up to heaven and see someday, if I was good. If it's bad, I don't know what's going to happen to me. Still haven't figured it out. But then when this science of the Christ began to take an active power in my thinking, I actually began to cultivate within my consciousness a deep sense of the actual presence and power of God. A sense that does nothing but grow deeper and richer and fuller with each passing year. Should have been very good said one time, my days of soldiering. It'd been a cold, snowy December's night. Fighting was rough. Actually, it simmered down a bit, but it was just a lull before the storm, just a few days before the Battle of the Bulge. And I was ordered to drive from the front lines back to a border country. The drive was to be done at night under cover of darkness. Blackout conditions prevailed. As some of you may know, in blackout driving, you use no headlights. You have to keep yourself free from being spotted by aerial observation, so you just learn to get into a vehicle, put your hands on the steering wheel, and then just poke your nose out the side of the door and watch the edge of the highway as it goes along to guide you. Approaching the border country, there have been implanted concrete and steel spikes. They stood about as high as this microphone, 5 foot, maybe a 4 foot square base, pyramidal in shape. They were dubbed dragon's teeth, ran for miles up and down what's called the Siegfried Line, placed there to keep enemy tanks from rolling freely from Germany into Holland. Driving along at 30 miles an hour, which is considered regulation blackout speed, I crashed head on into one of these dragon's teeth. One that had been left standing in the middle of the road, invisible to my eye, following the edge of the highway. That Jeep was totally wrecked. So was my thinking. Junk of every name in nature flooded in on me. How would I ever get out of this place to begin with? Miles from nowhere. Intelligence reports had told us that the enemy was infiltrating our lines, dressed in our uniforms, speaking flawless English. We had been ordered to stop and talk to no one. That meant no one was going to stop and talk to us. And if somebody did stop, well, then we really had a problem on our hands. How would I handle physical injuries? 3 other men in the vehicle with me, all of them lying unconscious in the roadway from injuries received in this accident. A really dark moment. A moment that required but one thing. Faith. But not some blind, emotional, foolish faith based on some faraway God, but a very intelligent, understanding faith. A faith based on the immediate presence of God, of spiritual good. For weeks prior to this accident with the Jeep, I had been reading in this textbook, I was a relatively new student of this religion. Just a little over a year had I been actually working at it. And I was forced to work at it now because I was scared stiff. I was in frontline combat. I needed everything I could get a hold of to keep my own thoughts strengthened and bolstered. And I was beginning to learn the power of right thinking. More specifically, the power of a spiritual idea at work in the human consciousness. And I had discovered that this textbook could open up my thinking to all kinds of spiritual ideas. And I just latched on every one of them I could get a hold of. For the first time in my life, I was learning about an entirely new kind of man. Not the man that I had grown up to believe in, the man of brain and bone and blood and hair and organs and muscles, etc. Not that kind of a man at all. But man, that Mrs. Eddy says, is made in the exact image of Spirit God. Now just think of man that is made up of nothing but God's qualities. Man, a totally indestructible, invulnerable being. An indestructible being that has absolute dominion over the so-called human or physical being. Well, all through the drive that night, I had been thinking about this marvelous concept of an indestructible man. So much so that at the actual moment of impact, it was as though I wasn't even in that vehicle. My own inspired thinking kept me free from the laws surrounding that accident itself. With the crash, then all of the doubts, the fears flooded in on me. But by now, there was enough of a cultivated spiritual understanding at work within me that I could turn on them, drive them from me, and with spiritual thinking restored, just instantly, help came. It was absolutely miraculous to human sense. Very natural, I have since learned, to spiritual sense. I can't go into great detail here, it takes too long, but very quickly, I can tell you that at 2 o'clock in the morning, we were hauled off to a field hospital, a tent hospital. The examining doctor, under x-ray, said that I had broken ribs, internal injuries and bleeding, hemorrhaging, the steering column had been jammed back into me. I didn't know it. At 9 o'clock in the morning, 7 hours later, under a second x-ray examination, he didn't know it. He couldn't find a thing wrong with me. He couldn't believe those two sets of x-ray plates. That was the first remarkable physical healing I'd ever experienced in this religion. 4 days later, I rejoined my unit at the front lines, and my men thought I was a ghost. I had been listed as killed in action for the days that I was missing. And I can tell you, the only reason we were rescued that night is that a truckload of black soldiers came along. And the one thing we knew the enemy did not have, nor could they disguise, were black soldiers. They were all Americans, and we were thrilled to see them. Here then we see that faith is cultivable. It can be cultivated, educated into a spiritual understanding that in so doing will bring new aims, new motives, new purposes, new drives into our lives. Faith that is cultivated into spiritual understanding can absolutely wipe out, eliminate from your thinking all fear, all doubt. In order to honestly study any question, one always should look at both sides of the picture, the other side of the coin, as it were. And at the other end of the spectrum from faith is doubt. What do I mean by doubt? One thing I don't mean is a rather healthy skepticism with which we can meet some of our ills in France in my student days. I learned an old proverb the Frenchman has for a healthy skepticism of that nature. Now and then you'll hear a Frenchman say, "No error can resist a sufficiently rigorous application of doubt." Sounds kind of Frenchy, doesn't it? You want to get rid of your errors, just doubt them? Well, that's not what I mean by doubt, really. By doubt, I mean all of that wavering of judgment, that indecisiveness of opinion. Goes on within all of us all too often. You know it as well as I. We've probably experienced gasoline stations in the last few weeks. Can I? Can't I? Will she? Won't she? Is it? Isn't it? Could I? Couldn't I? In fact, Webster defines doubt as being undecided as to the truth of the negative or affirmative propositions. So every bit of the pussyfooting, all of the fence straddling that we do with our lives is the product of doubt. What does secret fact can tell you about your life? The Bible very interestingly says that a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. And for our study, it's of interest to know that the words double and doubt have a basic root meaning, far back as the Anglo-Saxon, trifle, up to the Latin, duo, for two. So to be double-minded is to be doubtful-minded, and vice versa. A very obvious question you might ask me now is, but am I guilty of double-mindedness, dualism, doubt? And I'll say, sure you are, and so am I. We're full of it. If and whenever we consent to believe in a God mind that believes both in matter and spirit, or if we think we can really serve God and mammon, which Jesus said we could not do, you see, it's a strong faith that will not take that kind of thinking. A strong faith says, why? Why do I have to put up with all of this double-minded, dualistic, doubtful mishmash of thought that keeps pouring at me? And it's an intelligent faith that can answer that and does so on this basis. It looks at anyone's life who has grounded their thinking in the absolute reality of matter and physicality, with a natural outcome in that life of nothing but a parade of sin, sickness, disease, illicit affairs, loneliness, grief, lack, limitation, deprivation of every name in nature, death as its final outcome. And then a really intelligent faith goes to work and looks at someone's life, someone who has grounded their thinking in the absolute reality of God, spiritual good, with a natural outcome in that life of ever increasingly better and better health, holiness, wholesomeness, wholeness, self-completeness, holiness, purity, spontaneity of thought, originality of expression, creativity, immortality as its concomitants. And then remembering the words of Jesus, it's the spirit that quickeneth, the flesh profiteth nothing. Then it's really an intelligent faith that can begin to show us that matter and physicality, of which the flesh is surely one form, has in and of itself no quickening. Did you ever stop to think that all the flesh in the world wouldn't make the Oakland A's a world championship team? They've got to get some spirit from some source. And in the highest sense of that word spirit, it's only God's spirit that can really quicken any body, be it a sports body, a church body, a political body, a school body, a financial body, a home body, or a physical body. And little by little, someday, we're going to wake up to discover that all that this body ever gets is the belief or the faith that we keep wittingly or unwittingly, willingly or unwillingly, implanting or educating into it. I grew up in a rural community of northern Indiana, attended a rural township school that had a very poor library program in it. My mother, in order to offset that, would drive some 40 miles every week to Fort Wayne, Indiana, to the Carnegie Library, where she would bring home a whole stack of books, which she expected her children to work over nights after we got home from school. There were six children in my family. Being of English heritage, one of the books which she selected was John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress. That's the dullest thing a 13-year-old ever got a hold of. But I've learned to appreciate that book since becoming a student of Christian Science. Many of you may recall that Mr. Bunyan has a leading character whose name is Christian. One day, going out on a journey, Christian comes to Doubting Castle. Sounds grim, doesn't it? Gets worse. Because when he gets there, he finds that Doubting Castle is being taken care of by someone named Giant Despair. Now, it really gets bad because Giant Despair goes and marries a girl whose name is Diffidence, which means distrustful, unconfident. I think that's the most unholy union in all literature. But that's a very prophetic allegory. Decades ago, Mr. Bunyan was trying to tell mankind something, and it's of deep interest to us spiritually. For one could genuinely liken the ever-so-standardized, humanized, materialized Christian concept of a matter-based physical universe to a doubting castle. Locked up in it, pounding it, pinching it, squeezing it, feeling it, probing it, cutting it to find out how well you are or aren't. Imprisoned in it, not knowing how you're ever going to get out of it unless you die out of it. Who isn't bound to eventually grow up into a state of giant despair? And then go get hooked up with diffident, distrustful, unconfident thinking. For to always keep looking into that world of matter and physicality, with an up that always ends in a down, an action that always ends as a reaction, a production that always ends as a destruction, an involvement that always ends as a dissolvement, is to always be at the mercy of double-mindedness and doubt. Very gratefully, Christian Science has come to tell mankind that matter and physicality in and of themselves are not our real problem. Far from it. Since we seem to be in a physical body, in a physical world, and in a material universe, then we've the right to have as much of them and to enjoy as much of them as we can maintain a wholesome, healthy sense of dominion over. It's only when matter and physicality begin to hold dominion over us that we really got a problem on our hands. For what the human mind has learned to put its faith and belief in and call reality is not reality to spiritual mind, God. It's unreality. And once an individual has begun to cultivate his faith into spiritual understanding, then he progressively loses his faith in matter and in physical understanding. Just as Abraham's higher concept of God and man saved him from the traditional beliefs of his elders, so can your and my ever-increasingly higher concept as to the total spiritual nature of our true being save us from the traditional beliefs of matter and physicality. And that's all that matter and physicality are. They are nothing but traditional beliefs. No matter how many thousands of generations have traditionally believed them, no matter how deeply entrenched they seem to be in our thinking. For we have seen that faith can be cultivated into spiritual understanding. And spiritual understanding simply becomes an understanding of spirit, God, of God's allness, of God's everywhere presence. And this spiritual understanding at work in your consciousness precludes all matter, all physicality, at every turn of the road. And the insurmountable, which all too often seems to be physicality, becomes surmountable as thought is educated to rise above it. You realize that in today's world, living, that there are millions of people, and more joining them every year, who actually believe that there is no God, that there is no divine purpose or reason for humanity's existence, that our being here is but the product of a biological incident or an accident, that objects discernible to physical sight, not a phenomenon,
is the only true reality there is. So says the agnostic. Now, if that's true, and let's think for a moment that might be, then where do you think we would be this very evening if at some place along the line somewhere there hadn't been somebody with enough gumption to look beyond the evidence of matter and physical sight? He could still be swinging a club and wearing a loincloth as a caveman. We could be 20 million years back in the Miocene period. That's exactly where we would be. But don't you see the very nature of a truly intelligent, understanding faith is to look beyond matter and physical sight with a talent inherent in every one of us called insight. Insight, which is actually a cultivated spiritual understanding. It's your ability, my ability, to learn to know ourselves, the people around us, our world, our universe, from an exclusively spiritual point of view. Jesus did it. I think the most obvious feature of the ministry of this man Jesus is that he was constantly forcing the thought of his disciples to look beyond the evidence of physicality. An obvious moment occurred just a few days after the attempt to kill Jesus had failed. And he was approached by one of his disciples who refused to believe that this was Jesus. Do you remember Thomas? Doubting Thomas. Oh, doubt again. So our master, in order to prove his identity, permitted Thomas to come up and actually feel the nail prints in the palm of his hands, the spear wound in his side. And then and only then would Thomas agree that this was indeed Jesus. And then Jesus said a very remarkable thing, and it was this: Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me, and yet have believed. In modern parlance, that would be just like Jesus saying, do you want me to tell you something, Tom? Anybody is blessed if he doesn't need to touch matter or look at matter or feel physicality or poke it or pound it or pinch it to know that I am actually the very expression of Spirit God. Don't you see, Tom? I'm totally spiritual in my true being, and that's why they can't kill it. That's why they can't destroy it. That's why they can't get rid of it. This was the very basis of the progressive Christianity that Christ Jesus came preaching and teaching. It was this concept as to the total spiritual nature of his true being that earned for him the title, the Christ. It's his Christ being that gave him such dominion. The Bible says he can heal all manner of disease. Why? Because he never permitted his thinking, his faith, to ever get invested into matter or into physicality, which are the procuring cause of all disease. He kept his own thinking, his own mind, so imbued and so aligned to the world of Spirit God that he could literally say, I and my Father are one. Christian Science has come to tell mankind that if we will gain and never lose sight of that vision that Jesus had of himself to be the Christ, then we can gain and never lose sight of that vision as true of ourselves. For as sons and daughters of God, each one of us has the same heritage that Jesus has. Each one of us has the same heavenly father-mother principle for our source that Jesus has. Each of us has the right to know our own Christ being. And as for matter and physicality, even if it does look real and feel real and seem real, even if one does seem to live in it and work in it and breathe in it, you still don't need to educate your thinking, cultivate your faith deeper and deeper into it. And you won't if you ever begin to see anything of the spiritual Christ nature of your true being. When we come to have more faith
in the truth of being. We read from this book earlier tonight. Don't you see how this puts a whole new accent on faith? How this elevates faith to your spiritually understanding your perfection as man? And how consonant that is with what Jesus meant when he said, ye be perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect? What do you think God's going to have in his kingdom but a perfect man? And where do you think God is going to get that perfect man? If he doesn't get him from without your consciousness, your thinking, and from within my consciousness, my thinking. You'll never get it in a physical body, so don't look for it there. Isaiah saw that long before Jesus did. Isaiah went around the countryside saying, cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? That's like saying, stop believing in a man who thinks that he lives by the virtue of a heartbeat, who thinks he breathes with lungs, or sees with eyes, or hears with ears, or thinks with a brain. You can't account for that man in the final instance, so stop it, Isaiah said. And then Isaiah turns right around and quotes God as saying, ye are my witnesses that I am God. It's only spiritual understanding that enables us to bear witness to our perfection as spiritual man. And this becomes increasingly revealed within each one of us as we individually learn to cultivate, educate our belief into faith and our faith into spiritual understanding. This was the insight, the spiritual insight on the part of Mrs. Eddy herself into the teachings of Christ Jesus that led her to write her scientific statement of being, that which predicates all of this unique system of thinking. Part of which actually says, there is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. And that ends with these lines. Therefore, man is not material. He is spiritual. Her own bitter, agonizing years forced her thinking to see beyond matter, which she saw was nothing but fleshly human will, into the realm of spirit, God, which she saw is true mentality, divine will. She saw that God is indeed the only mind, the only source of genuine true intelligence and right ideas. And she saw that since it's the sole province of any mind to know, then God's mind's knowing is comprised in spiritual ideas, and those spiritual ideas are each one of us in our true nature as the Christ. God, divine mind, individualizes himself as man, his spiritual idea. Each one of us has the ability each day of getting to know more and more about his own Christ being. Each of us has the joy of learning to know and feel his own invulnerable, indestructible spiritual being. Each of us has the necessity in this day and age to refuse to accept matter and physicality on its terms. And by matter and physicality, one has to mean all sin, all sickness, all disease, all death, all abnormality, all immorality, lack, limitation of any name and nature. Because life without doubt is the illimitable Christ life. It's just learning to keep your own heart and soul and mind so imbued with the world of spirit, God, that you can literally write your own title clear to mansions in the skies. Why, if you do that, you'll never again find yourself dwelling in a doubting castle. It's always here the obvious question arises. Yes, but how? How does one achieve this great spiritual goodness? You know, a promise in the teachings of Jesus is that we shall be able to do his works and even greater works than these. What do you think could possibly be a greater Christian goal, a greater Christian aim for any one of us than to start from this moment on and get our life to the point where we do nothing but build a totally spiritualized consciousness. Man, that's really mind expansion. Mind expansion, you know, is the very essence of flower power. The whole hippie movement was predicated on building an expanded consciousness through drugging, but they discovered they couldn't make it by LSD. You'll never get it on that trip. You'll get it only through hard work, through the hard work of learning to educate, cultivate, force your human thinking beyond the limitations of matter and physical sense-based testimony. This becomes a life-giving process in which one actually learns to come day after day, face to face, with his spiritual being. And this is prayer. Prayer is simply finding out who we are, spiritual man. Prayer is essentially attitude. Our attitude toward any given set of circumstances or conditions is our prayer about it. Do you ever stop to think that your attitude towards your husband is your prayer about him? Your attitude towards your wife is your prayer about her? Careful what you pray for. Our attitude toward our home, toward our schoolwork, toward our university, toward our neighbor, toward our business, toward our children, toward our nation, our president, is essentially our prayer about them. In the right attitude, you progressively wipe out, destroy in your thinking all ignorance, all hatred, all jealousy, all personal sense, all grief, all laziness, all apathy, all torpor, indifference, doubt. In this kind of praying, you don't need to beg. No pleading. You wouldn't even ask God for a bicycle. There's no emotionalism here. By in this kind of praying, you not only learn to know your nearness to God, you're actually being in God's presence.